protecting children, and particularly children whose parents are going through divorce or separation. And what we have discovered, and it's been going on for decades across the country, across the world, and yes, even across Marin County. When we first started this, we thought this was solely a problem in Marin, and we did a documentary film about how the courts, you know, two parents go in to get a divorce, and oftentimes, you know, majority of times when parents go in for a divorce, they're able to put the best interests of the children at the forefront, and they don't even end up in front of judges in court. But the majority of cases that do end up in front of judges involve typically domestic violence or child sexual abuse. And what we have discovered through research and experience and lots of firsthand accounts is an epidemic in our family court system, where judges are routinely placing children with a violent or abusive parent when there's a perfectly loving, safe parent that they're taking completely out of their children's lives. So the parent that has been protecting the child through violence or sexual abuse, and oftentimes divorces occur just because that is revealed to a parent, that the other parent's harming them. It's exactly the opposite of how the courts are supposed to be operating. Their mission, and by law, they're supposed to be protecting the best interests of children. And what's happening is a 180 of that. So kids are routinely being harmed, and the very conservative estimate is 58,000 children a year in the U.S. are being court ordered into abusive situations. So it's a big problem.
What kind of standards do the judges look for as the parent who should be maintaining the custody of the child? I mean, what are they looking for? How do you see them getting this wrong?
Yeah, there's a best interest test, and you know, judges are looking at who has a more stable income, who has a larger home, or obviously if they're just divorcing and it's early in the process, they're coming from a joint marital home typically, but who has more resources is often what determines where the children get placed. And we actually have a resolution that was just introduced in July in the U.S. Congress that would be the first time ever that the Congress weighs in on family courts and tells the courts, gives them direction, and says child safety needs to be the primary determination when looking at the best interests of children. Because right now, judges will routinely make decisions based on who looks more stable. And you can imagine, if you've been in a domestic violence marriage for decades, and I know Sarah will talk some about this, you come out of that and you're PTSD. You know, when you leave your abuser is when you're most vulnerable as well. And so you go into court and the judge sees someone completely frazzled and terrified, and someone who's calm, cool, and collected. And a lot of people who come in who are abusing their children are narcissistic, and they have, you know, a great mask that they wear in the world, and the judges get duped by that often. They're not trained as they should be often in domestic violence and child abuse. There's a lot of junk science that the courts are steeped in that believe that whenever an abuse allegation is raised, then the children have been coached to lie in court. And so this is the waters in which a vulnerable parent comes into trying to protect their children. They often are unaware of the fact that bringing up abuse is a surefire way to lose custody of your children. And lawyers across the country tell their clients, even if your kids are being beaten or raped, don't bring it up in court because the judge is going to punish you. Because in family court, they believe that whoever is most willing to share the children is the better parent. And so even if you have medical evidence of abuse, which many of the parents we work with have physical evidence of abuse, or police reports, broken bones that have occurred when they're with their abusive parent, oftentimes that evidence is just ignored because they believe that here's just a vindictive, oftentimes the mother trying to make a case to get custody away from the other parent, not recognizing that there's legitimate abuse going on.
And it's amazing. And certainly the financial side of things, that would make the judge have less interest of really digging deeper. And certainly they have so many cases before them to dig into each one and to give each one the justified time that it needs to have. I wonder if there's a play in that too, of just the number of cases they have. How authentic can they be to each one?
Well, right, and there is an issue that a lot of people don't realize. In family court, you don't have a jury. You have one individual who's deciding the fate of your family and your children, and you don't have a right to an attorney in family court. So people who are suspected criminals in America have more rights to legal representation, to have a lawyer to defend themselves, than parents who are going through divorce, who are fleeing, oftentimes registered sex offenders, convicted felons, the rap sheets on some of these parents. And if you're the abuser and you have access to resources, you can get the best lawyer money can buy. So one of the early cases that we were supporting, there was an immigrant mom from Senegal and here in Marin County who had very little resources against a multimillionaire dad. And he had the chair of the family law section of the Marin County Bar Association as his attorney. And she had to put on a case herself, having never taken a deposition, not knowing anything about the legal system. So you can imagine what the outcome's going to be if you have an unlevel playing field where whoever has more money, who can buy the lawyer, who's friends with the judge, or who's been in front of the judge on a daily basis, and you're fumbling through because you have no money, you have no attorney.
And you're being judged on how well you present in a courtroom. I mean, that is somehow establishing you as a credibility, as your intelligence. And how did that come to be, right? Certainly a person who is more educated in the system will have a better face than a person who is new to the system.
Absolutely. And there was a very prominent attorney just last week in the New York Times, Richard Posner, who came out and said he was in a 35-year slumber as a federal judge, and then he realized that self-represented litigants are getting shafted in courts across the country, and he's retiring because he wants to remedy this injustice that's happening to people who have no attorneys. And our court system in California, it's over 80% of all family law litigants have no money for an attorney. And you can imagine if you're up against a parent that does have an attorney, they're going to present a much tighter case. The judge is going to be more pleasant with them because they're not trying to figure out the rules as they're getting into a hearing or presenting evidence. So there's a lot of biases against low-income people in addition to victims of violence in the court system.
You're listening to Kathleen Russell. She's the director of Center for Judicial Excellence. And we are here at Take That talking about family courts and a lot of injustices that are happening to the children specifically. They're being placed in abusive homes and trying to understand why this is happening. So Sarah, thank you for joining us. I'd love to hear your story. You have a pretty personal story regarding these issues.
I do. Thanks, Barbara. As Kathleen was describing, the system is not set up at this point in the family courts to protect children or victims of domestic violence, the majority of whom are women. And my personal situation was escaping from a 10-year marriage with copious amounts of domestic violence, primarily psychological and emotional abuse. It was always the overarching threat of physical harm, however. And when I did escape and had to then share custody of our children with my ex-husband, it became very clear and quickly apparent that something was wrong, something was going on. And I was still in a pretty terrified place after having gotten out of this situation, as Kathleen mentioned, post-traumatic stress, and all sorts of trauma that continues to occur, and I think perhaps we're not very aware of that in this culture. The emphasis is on getting out of the situation, and we don't have any follow-up. What does a woman and her children do after that? Yes. And so I was living it firsthand, and what happens is that you are left on your own. There is nothing there. There is no support network. And even domestic violence shelters and the small resources that are available to women and children are so minimal. They're so overtaxed. And I called many of these places here in California, in Sonoma County, and they couldn't help me. They said, you know, we don't have the resources. And when it did become apparent that the children were being abused, specifically sexual and physical abuse, I, as any protective parent would do, was absolutely determined to keep my kids safe. And that is at the heart of this issue, is that the parents, most oftentimes the mothers, will do anything to protect her children. And what is scary but is true is that the system also knows that, the family court system, and they use that in order to keep litigation going, to keep the resources coming from the protective parent. And the abusive parent also knows this, and they use the court as a secondary means of the continuation of the abusive cycle. So you are now, after having escaped the abuse, continuing to be abused systematically by the family court system, the very system that supposedly is set up to protect you and your children. And so going to all the agencies I was supposed to go to, CPS, the police, after interviews with these different agencies, after getting custody evaluations costing tens of thousands of dollars, the determination was that my ex-husband was the better fit parent, that no abuse had occurred, that, as Kathleen mentioned, I was, number one, making everything up because I had a personal vendetta against him, and number two, that I had then coached my children into being fearful of their father. And all of the evidence that we had, as Kathleen mentioned, was documented. I had letters from therapists. I had notes, office notes of examinations in pediatrician's offices. I had police interviews. And after all those interviews and evidence and documentation, when we finally got to trial in the family court, which was over a 3-month-long trial, none of it was taken into consideration. And very pointedly, we would bring up evidence, which, in, as Kathleen was saying, in criminal courts, would have been more than enough. It was considered either irrelevant, or there was some code or restriction or specific law that prevented the judge from taking it into consideration. So as far as personally feeling the repercussions of the system is devastating, and it's devastating on a daily basis. And so think about what we're doing as a culture to our most vulnerable people, to our children and to our mothers who are trying to care for and protect these children. And instead of supporting them, instead of coming together as a community and saying, we support you, you're safe, you did the right thing, and now we're going to carry you forward, we are punishing those mothers and children. And it's a re-victimization. We are blaming the victims.
That's right, and lawyers at $400 an hour in Marin County, they're not too eager to let you go either. I mean, mediators, about the same price per hour. The books that there is a divorce system out there that's highly expensive.
It's a multi-billion-dollar industry.
Multi-billion-dollar industry. Mm-hmm. What's the wedding industry?
Yeah, right, right.
The in and the out. Wow. And once you establish a system, it needs to feed itself.
That's right. Right.
And that's where we're at right now, mm-hmm. on top of other things as well. But it's a system that won't go away unless it breaks.
That's right.
And maybe that's what we're trying to do right now, is to penetrate and find out what is going wrong here. I am so sorry that you had to go through that. Kathleen, what do you have to say about, is this a normal situation? Are these stories that you hear?
Yeah. What Sarah describes, and sadly, is what's happening all over the country. And the reason I know this, and it's interesting, when we did our film about Marin County, we threw together some resources in 2007, and we filmed a film in about 2.5 months. and got it aired, screened at the Lark Theater, which was like standing room only, and thought it was only a Marin County problem. We took a little 12-minute clip of the film and put it on YouTube, and suddenly the floodgates were open, and parents all over the country called and said, what you're describing in Marin County in that film is what's happening to me, and I've lost certain friends and family who ostracized me or felt that I was deceiving them or not being honest with them because they couldn't imagine how my ex, who has a history of domestic violence or is sex abuse or what, name the crime, DUI, multiple DUIs, whoever has the longer rap sheet is the one getting custody. At least these are the cases that we hear about. And I've had less than five people in the 11 years we've been doing this tell me, actually, the courts got it right with my case. Obviously, those people aren't calling us in crisis like the people that are whose kids are being harmed, but we can finish people's sentences when they call. It's like we know what the next step in the process is going to be because it is systematic the way in which children are taken from their safer, nurturing parent and removed from them entirely. And the other piece of this, which is so draconian, people don't realize, is we have in our family court system something called supervised visitation, mm-hmm. which was created so that people who truly are difficult parents or have trouble putting their children's best interests first or are violent criminals, they are afforded the ability to continue to have a relationship with their kids. And it's a supervised setting. There's a place here in Marin called Apple Works, and there's another one, I'm forgetting the name now. But that's where violent or parents who've been accused of abuse are supposed to go to continue to visit with their kids. And what the courts have been doing nationwide is putting the safe, protective parent into the supervised visit. So imagine you're Sarah and you're fleeing domestic violence, you have no resources, you are in a court system, and they say you're the liar, that you're the bad parent. And on top of that, you're going to have to pay child support to the batterer because he got the kids full time, which is very common. And you're going to have to pay $50 to $100 an hour to visit with your own children in often a locked facility, which is no place to have a meaningful bond with your child. So supervised visitation is there for the very reason that we should be able to continue to have relationships with kids, regardless of what the allegations are, and let the investigation work itself out. But it's being twisted and manipulated so that these safe, loving parents, who their only crime is that they went to court and tried to protect their kids. But in family court, that's viewed as the ultimate sin and this junk science that has perpetuated in family court is at the root of it. And a lot of that really got started in Marin County back in the 80s. So this is very much a hotbed of family court corruption. And we have gotten lately to calling it judicial child trafficking because people in America now understand what sex trafficking is. And it's, you know, basically trading children for money, and that's what we're seeing in family courts and have been for decades now. It's over 1 million children if you look at the 58,000 a year figure, and this really started kicking up in the mid-80s. So there are over 1 million children in this country who have been forced into abusive homes, taken from the parent that is their primary attachment figure. In some cases, people that weren't even raising the child can swoop in and get custody from a parent that's been the only parent that child has known their entire life. You don't have to have a PhD in psychology to know how damaging that is to children to be ripped away from their loving parent. So it's a real crisis. And there's another ugly thing that has roots in here in Marin County are these reunification camps. And there are psychologists in this community who've lost their licenses and continue to get court appointed to take children into hotel rooms in Marin County, in Larkspur and Corte Madera. And we have firsthand accounts from teenagers who've been flown from Virginia, from Michigan, from other states by court order and brought to these hotels and threatened over a period of 4 days that they need to love their abusive parent, and basically it's like a brainwashing, kind of like they used to do with LGBTQ youth, is they would try to brainwash them and say, you're not gay, and you know, we're going to convince you otherwise. And this is what's happening at $45,000 a pop. And so abusive parents go into court and convince the judge that this is their last chance at getting a relationship with the child who doesn't want to see them. And it's not because the parent has coached them to dislike the other parents. They've been terrified of this parent, or this parent's harmed them for years. So,
and kids are so highly intuitive. They understand more often than not what's going on. However, in the cases where stories begin to build, where they have to go to these visitation halls and they have people surrounding them telling them what to do, children are very vulnerable. They start to question that safe parent, right?
That's right.
Well, and they're often threatened that they'll never see the safe parent again unless they cooperate with the program. And these are already suicidal kids, or kids who are cutting, who are being brought into this whole system. And they often are kicking and screaming and not wanting to leave, and they get abducted from family courts and from their own bedrooms. There's a whole industry now of these transport companies that are hired by a parent to grab their kids out of bed in the middle of the night and take them to these camps. So it's incredibly traumatizing to children, and how the system that's supposed to say they're protecting kids is ordering this kind of abuse of children. It's teaching kids that telling the truth about abuse is going to harm you, it's not going to help you, and then they see the parent that's trying to protect them losing everything in court. And I mean, this is something that needs to be clear. These parents who are fighting to protect their kids are losing everything. They're losing their homes, their jobs, their life savings, their parents' life savings.
They're being traumatized.
And they're being pushed into poverty. Middle-class parents often are pushed into poverty, and yet we've tried numerous times to get philanthropists and foundations to recognize that if you're for a social justice foundation and you want to eradicate poverty or help lift families out of poverty or eradicate child sex abuse, you can't do that unless you look at what's happening in the family court system, because it is systematic in terms of the harm that is happening to parents and children.
Sarah, I'm interested from your story. You left an abusive situation. Did you feel stigmatized by that very act of just leaving a family? And I'm also, just for honesty here, disclaimers and all of that, I've also come out of a very similar situation of a very emotionally abusive marriage relationship of 20 years. It was a number of years ago that I experienced that, and I also left that, and I would not have believed it was true unless I had experienced it as well, and it's so profound. And the guilt of not thinking that maybe you didn't do something right, and you couldn't save your marriage, you couldn't save your family, and that trauma just of that alone, and then trying to protect your family. Tell me more about that experience for you.
Well, I think you have it exactly right, Barbara. It's you already feel isolated in your relationship, in your marriage, because the abusive partner specifically isolates you. It's not crazy or made up. It's that the other person has control of the resources, almost always. The other person has control of you emotionally, almost always. And the other person holds the threat over your head of retaliation against you and your children, if you were to ever leave. So that's a pretty powerful combination. And we often, and I was a personal recipient of extreme criticism and blame. Well, why would you stay with somebody like that for 10 years? I don't understand. And we have a woeful lack of education about domestic violence in the United States of America. Woeful lack of education about child abuse, child sexual abuse, what it looks like, what the symptoms are, what the repercussions are. And so already feeling isolated and crazy for multiple years, simultaneously trying to protect my very young children in an extremely volatile situation. Once I was out of the situation, then it was that isolation times 10. Because even when you're in it, in an abusive situation, it's known territory. It's scary, and you are living in fear every second of the day. But you know it. It's comfortable. Mm-hmm. And when you step out that door, get in your car, whatever, however you make that first movement towards freedom, it is absolutely terrifying. Yes. I mean, it, and it's something you really, I don't think I could put it into words exactly, because it's such a somatic felt experience. And I so have such compassion and understanding for women and children who are victims, because it is, unless you have experienced it firsthand, it is so very difficult to understand. And that's why we need advocates, true advocates for victims, who can speak to this. And my community completely ostracized me. Friends I'd had for years wouldn't speak to me anymore. I lost a whole half of a family, his family. And I had people who were actively now out to get me because I had spoken up and I'd spoken the truth.
Yep.
But this is what we see, I think, across the board in multiple issues, social justice issues, environmental justice issues. Whoever speaks up and tells the truth has come after.
That's right. I don't know why that is, and I just want to comment on incredible courage. Even being here and talking as you are right now, because I think your voice and your story give support to so many other people who are going through it and can't even articulate it. It's because it's such, you describe it so well, it's such an emotional place that when you are going through that emotional journey, you can't even understand what it is because you're so deep in it.
That's right.
And yeah, it's interesting you said that about friends dropping off. I mean, it was like within days I had Facebook friends, men, husbands, friend, just completely disappear. And so not only is your family falling apart, but you're suddenly coming maybe face to face to other truths and illusions around your life that you believed were true. Yes, Kathleen, you have a thought?
Yeah, I just wanted to also mention, when you start to speak out about the system failing families, how you become a target as well. So what's happening in individual relationships then gets transferred to the court system. And so we actually pushed forward with Senator Mark Leno, who represented Marin back in 2008 and 2009, an audit of the Marin Family Court. And we were specifically looking at the training of these court-employed mediators, and we found out none of them were trained in domestic violence or child abuse. And this is the first stop you go to when you're going through a divorce or separation. So, but we were fought every step of the way on this audit, and the local court actually would not let the state auditor come in for 10 months. She had to threaten them with subpoenas, and we later found out a year later that they had had a massive shredding party, and they had destroyed all of these mediator records, which were the most substantive notes that they would take, as they would interview the child's principals and teachers and neighbors and anybody who each parent said knew about the status of this family. And that success, we actually exposed that had happened. And then the Judicial Council of California came in with a report that said basically this was totally above board. They just needed to create space in the storage room at the courthouse. And these weren't really official court records, yet they were the very records that lawyers routinely subpoenaed when they were going to cross-examine a mediator. Because these mediators have so many cases, they can't keep them straight, and their notes is what allowed them to recollect as they were being cross-examined on the stand. So these are very much court records, and yet that policy, that set statewide policy, and we later found out from mediators in Nevada City, for example, that they were destroying mediator notes as well. And so there's a lawsuit right now in San Francisco. We got the first ever audit of the Commission on Judicial Performance, which is the only oversight agency in the state for judges. Its mission is to protect the public, and we got the first audit in 56 years since it was created, because their own reports on their website show that if you're a member of the public complaining about a judge, the chance of you getting discipline of your judge is less than 4%. But if you're a district attorney, it's about 50% or so. So the public, who's supposed to be protected by this agency, is absolutely not being protected. So the state auditor's job is to go into state agencies and look at their records and their finances and make sure they're you know, doing what they're supposed to be doing through state constitution and mandate. And they went into court 6 weeks after a unanimous vote of the Joint Legislative Audit Committee And they sued the state auditor to say that this was highly confidential information that she was not privileged to see and that they didn't trust her. Meanwhile, that's what she does every day, is look at highly confidential information and make sure that it's not released to the public. So this is an ongoing lawsuit. It's been over a year since this unanimous vote. And the state legislature, I mean, there are checks and balances in our government, right? There's the judicial branch, the executive branch, and the legislative branch. And that, you know, judges have enormous power, and it's completely unchecked in the state. And here was an attempt by the people. We had organizations from all over the state, labor unions, SEIU, and others, good government groups, saying that this was an important audit, and yet they go into the courts themselves and try to stop this. And it's just been a delaying tactic for sunshine and accountability. And there's a long history. And, you know, they love to say these are just a bunch of disgruntled litigants who are making a mountain out of a molehill.
Right.
And, you know, how many disgruntled litigants is it going to take before they recognize that, you know, this is system failure.
And by that, it is a system failure and a reflection of a blight that needs to be fixed. And then maybe there's that fear that having a blight within your county is a reflection on the leaders themselves. And that's what I think is part of this hurdle, is to face that truth, right? And to question. We have lost that ability to question. And I wonder why that is. Tell me about the relationship that judges have with the lawyers and that circuit. You and I had talked about this earlier, mm-hmm. and it was really interesting to me about the kind of relationship that the judges have with other members in that system.
Right. Well, California has the lowest rate in the nation of contested judicial campaigns and races. So 8% of judges in our state have opponents when they run for re-election. That is by far the lowest in the nation. So this notion that, oh, if you don't like a judge, you can just, you know, vote them out of office. Well, we've had a couple of people in Marin County that have tried to run against incumbent judges, and they get squashed because, you know, it's a very tight community in Marin, and the lawyers protect the judges, and the Bar Association is very chummy with the local bench, and there is, you know, just not a lot of opportunity for sunshine there. So the people that finance judicial campaigns in this community are also the attorneys who appear before the judges. And, you know, the judges are supposed to recuse themselves or identify when there's conflicts of interest. That rarely happens. So you can imagine if there's a domestic violence case, which is very common in family courts, and an abuser has hired a member of the bar who's given finances to the judge in their campaign, and you've got a frazzled parent who's got no resources and no attorney, you know, it's human nature. Judges have biases, and that's why this Commission on Judicial Performance is there to try to put checks in, make sure that there aren't systemic biases that are harming the public. And so, yeah, you have a system that's very insular. Most people in our country don't vote on judges' races, or it's the least voted on, because people don't know where to go to get information about. It's a very secretive branch of government. And so unless you've been unfortunate enough to have to go through the court system, you often don't know. And so people just say, oh, I'll vote for the name on the ballot. And there's very little to no oversight, and that's something our organization has been fighting for, is more transparency, more accountability. I know there's Clean Money campaign in California, and there's people in that campaign who are pushing for more transparency around the finances. But this is big money. I mean, the family court system, people that are in it now and working, they're not so much the judges. They have job security because they have this community that doesn't really challenge them, but the psychologists that get appointed to these cases, the lawyers who get appointed to these cases, they are making big money on the system as it is. And so there, I mean, I can always predict whenever we have a progress or we pass something in the legislature, they'll say, oh, this is just sour grapes, disgruntled litigants. Yet I've never been a litigant, I don't have children, I'm not married, this is not personal for me at all or my board of directors. This is a human rights issue for children and women and men who are also victims of domestic violence. There's a lot of problems with collusion and cronyism, and this has been written about. SF Weekly did an incredible article in the year 2000 about Judge Michael Duffacy, who was a real problematic judge here in Marin for a long time, and that came out, and there's been other exposés. And
well, I can share my own little story, and I won't raise names just for to be polite here, in the courtroom after my mediation with my ex-husband, we had to present the papers, and we still hadn't reached an agreement, and I was taking it slow for the very reason of I didn't want to push buttons because I was afraid for my kids. And I was afraid for retribution. I was afraid that he would take it to a higher level, and I didn't have the source of money to take it there. And I had a lot of fear for my children as well. But going through that whole emotional role that you go through, and then being in a courtroom, and for a person who's ever been in a courtroom in that capacity, it's a very terrifying feeling with the judge way up high, people surrounding you, and you having to expose yourself of what you do feel as a failure. You know, I think we all want to have a successful marriage, a successful family. So you're already there in that capacity. But I was stunned during that experience because I was trying to be professional, kind, when I asked the judge for more time for us to settle our differences. And, we were both, my ex-husband and I, together in front of the judge. And she looked at me and she says, "No, there's no more time. This is your deadline. You better do it now." And it was pretty much those kind of words. Maybe not the exact words, but that sort of tone. Me, I always question how I might have explained it because I thought it was such a strange answer coming from her. I thought, well, maybe I didn't explain it right because that's always what I do. I self-doubt, which can be a gift and it can be a curse. And so I thought, well, let me reshape that so she understands my intention better. And so I did reshape it. And I will tell you, I have never experienced a reaction from anybody as I experienced from her. I felt like I was in the room of Judge Judy, that television. I think she had been actually inspired by Judge Judy. She leaned over the top of this desk that she was at in the most, to me, abusive power abuse. There's probably a better word for that. But looked at me, you know, way down below, and said, "Read my lips, no more time." Well, I think my jaw dropped onto the table. I would never believe a judge would talk to a non-criminal in that way, right? We're just divorcing, trying to figure out some issues from her, in her eyes. And I was, she pointed to the door and kicked me out of the courtroom. I was already emotional. That just ticked me off even more. I had the bailiff follow me out of that courtroom as if I were dangerous. Mm-hmm. Me, I'm so not dangerous. Maybe I am, I don't know, but not in that way. Mm-hmm. But he looked at me as if I did something so bad. And she had, as I came back into the courtroom and I sat down, and I was just so emotional. And of course, now my ex-husband has something on me, on paper. I got kicked out of a courtroom. I am emotionally unstable. Mm-hmm. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
And actually, a woman next to me in the courtroom leaned over and she said, "You did nothing wrong. I want you to know that. You were totally in the right." And she gave a name to that judge, which I won't repeat on air. And then the judge told me to wait my turn because I'm now being punished and I have to wait until everybody is done, which was a gift to me because I was able to watch her with everyone that she had in front of her, and the way that she handled everybody was the most abusive way. People who are emotional, people who are losing their children, and the fact that they didn't speak English, the fact that they didn't have money seemed to counter them, And to me, I was witnessing something I could never imagine.
Yeah, well, this particular judge is still on the bench, and many complaints have been filed about similar beratement and just horrible treatment of the public, and yet this judge has been essentially untouchable. So it really calls into question this whole commission on judicial performance, and it was a big fuel for our efforts to try to create some accountability in the agency that is supposed to be protecting the public. And,
right.
you know, people often say, oh, we just need more women judges. Well, in Marin County, women judges have been incredibly cruel. And I use that term very consciously. I've watched children beg these women to please protect me from my father, or, you know, don't make me go back there. And then when it comes to decision time, the judge will say, well, I didn't find the child to be believable or credible, but I thought Dr. So-and-so, who the abuser brought into court at $500 an hour, I found that person to be more credible, and I believe that the child was coached and that this is all made up by the vindictive parent who's trying to keep those children from the other parent. That's how this goes down. And, you know, women, it is a male-dominated world, the world of law and judging, and I do think that we're at a time where the women who do make it and become judges feel they have to be that much harder and that much tougher on women and, you know, to prove themselves somehow, and yet they are so destroying not just the parents that are being abused by them, but the children who are having to pay the price in so many of these cases. And our organization has been tracking the number of children murdered by a parent in family courts or related to divorce and custody nationwide, and we're approaching 600 kids in just the last 9.5 years. And most recently, close to home here, there were two children murdered in June, this past June in Sonoma County. And again, it was divorce-inspired and triggered, and this father, on Father's Day, took his kids for a visit and killed them and then killed himself. So, you know, those are the extreme cases. Fortunately, Marin hasn't had that yet, but given the amount of abuse, domestic violence is the number one violent crime in our community. People don't realize that often because it's not always getting prosecuted. But, you know, kids...
And certainly by talking about any of these issues in any county, maybe even this county too, it begins to mar what should be so perfect, right? I mean, everyone, we talk about Marin County as being this perfect county, but we really don't talk about some hard truths. Well, I mean, that's going to affect property prices. That's going to affect a lot of other inconvenient truths.
That's right.
Right?
Yep. Yep. No, yeah. There is a lot of people in Marin want to believe that we live in paradise, and I'm not exactly been the most popular person in the community for continuing to raise these issues, and, you know, that's just part of what goes with raising inconvenient truths, is that you're not going to win a popularity contest, and, you know, people will routinely dismiss us and say that we're just, you know, vexatious and have an axe to grind and are, you know, making a mountain out of a molehill, and yet we know from all the stories and all the evidence I've seen that this is an epidemic, and that's why after 11 years we have members of Congress now who are both Democrats and Republicans. We have liberal Democrats and conservative Republicans co-sponsoring this resolution, which says enough already. Child safety needs to be the number one priority. This resolution also calls for hearings in front of Congress about the failings of family court,
right.
and that these custody evaluators who are licensed psychologists need to be, you know, they need to have credentials. They need to be trained in domestic violence and child abuse and not pushing this junk science, which suggests that any time abuse comes up, it's a fabrication. And that's really at the root of a lot of this. But there's a lot of reason to be hopeful because of the progress that we've made. And, you know, when we first started this, it was like no one believed us. They thought we were exaggerating the number of children. And, I mean, who can refute dead children? You know, it's like the bodies are there, the articles are there, this is happening, and for every dead child, there's, you know, dozens more that are being ordered into abusive situations, and that's going to tax our society for the rest of their lives. They're going to, and people, I think why this hasn't been fixed is they go, oh, it's a he said, she said, everyone lies when they're getting a divorce. It's a personal family matter, and yet these kids are going to date your children, you know. That's what I like to say to people. It may not be affecting your immediate nuclear family, but these kids are going to become future inmates, because they've learned not to respect the courts, and we need to, you know, address this and recognize it's a drain on our public resources. Anyone who cares about, I mean, even if you don't care about the health of children in our communities, you should care about how much money is wasted when the system is failing families. And there have been a number of children murdered just this week in connection with divorce, and I've been reading all these articles about the police and how it's the most horrifying thing they've ever seen to have to go to that kind of a crime scene. And then psychologists are sent to meet with the officers and their families, and schools have grief counselors that are dispatched.
Right.
And I mean, where is all this money coming from? Shouldn't we be investing that in the future of raising healthy children, healthy communities?
You say it so well. And also back to your point, Sarah, about feeling like your community just faded away. I had that same experience. I mean, it was an amazing, powerful experience in that you people who you thought were friends, suddenly you realize are not friends. And there's an awakening that happens through all of that, which can be very, very painful. And I just wonder, as a call out there to listeners and, you know, others interested in the subject, is, wow, isn't this an opportunity to bring the community tighter together and realizing how we really need each other, especially during these times.
Right.
And be careful about judging too quickly on any situation. And it's a time for kindness and support.
I agree. And I think this is what I've come to in my personal life, personal experience, and in my sense of wanting to harvest a really horrible situation, is that I am now embarking on a graduate program at University of San Francisco in human rights education.
Yeah.
And the topic I am writing my thesis on and all of my papers and my work is this issue. It is a human rights crisis nationwide, and it's happening in our own backyard. It's not somewhere over there. It's right here, right now. And I have had similar experiences to Kathleen with people not wanting to hear it, not wanting to accept it. Even within a very highly educated community, it is very difficult to open up and bring awareness and truth to these very scary realities. And that's what we need to do, is number one, bring awareness. And then number two, as you just put it beautifully, Barbara, bring connection. We have to come together as a community in all of our individual areas and say, we're in this together. This is about the safety of our children. This is about the future generations of our world. And if we do not take a stand and do the right thing now, it's not going to happen.
And it's it takes a village to raise children. It really
Absolutely.
Is. I felt the experience where I was always the one. I mean, I'm the parent, so I am ultimately responsible. But you cannot do the job by yourself. And when they get to a certain age, you are the last person they even want to listen to. Right? So it's good to know that others in the community are valued for that, because people in the mm-hmm. village, they have a big influence on our children. And I certainly feel that is a connection today you really have to continue to build, because we are losing those connections on a pretty high level.
Yeah.
Doing too much judging too quickly, too.
Mm-hmm. Right, and it's cultivation. I mean, you have to... I'm a gardener, so
harvest cultivation. Well, where are you now? So, I mean, fantastic. You are getting your master's degree. I mean, you're taking a negative situation and really turning it into a powerhouse for other people. And it sounds like you're on your way to becoming a speaker and an advocate for other women. Thank you.
Well, it's my honor, and I am mindful of that responsibility and honor daily, and I do it 110% in dedication of my children. They are the ones who inspire me every day, their courage, their bravery. They have been court-ordered and forced back into unsupervised custody time with their father. So they spend several days with him, and we have, through much dialoguing and crying and brainstorming and, you know, coming together as a family, really talked about, okay, how can we support each other in this situation, and what can we do to shine a light, not just for ourselves, but for our world in this situation. And so when I go forward with my projects and journeys, I think about that often.
Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing your story, and I wish you the best of luck. I hope to have you on again. I want to continue
Thank
to hear
you.
Your work. And when will you finish your work, your master's?
So I just embarked.
Yes, fantastic.
Next year, and I'm hoping to go on to get my doctorate in law.
Fantastic. Well, you know, I started my master's right during that time, too, and I finished it 2 months ago.
Oh, hey! Congratulations!
It does awaken you to a place where you can really take all the negativity and create positivity, and maybe that's the gift, right? And that's the challenge in life.
Right. And while Sarah takes so much inspiration from her children, I get my inspiration from the courageous parents like Sarah, who I just don't know how they get out of bed in the morning, knowing that in often times their kids are in an abusive home and trying to stay safe and trying to stay alive, and to have to endure that on a daily basis is just a level of courage that I can hardly imagine. So I think there are so many brave parents in our community who are living through this and feeling a lack of support, and that's so much why we continue with our mission to give voice to these children and work in the state legislature, and we have passed laws to give kids more of a voice and to better protect them, because they are the future.
Yes, and you're quite the inspiration, Kathleen, for all the work that you're doing. Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Really, it's and it takes courage. It really takes courage to speak out and show what's not right. We all want to go what's right, and that fuzzy warm place,
yes,
and it's really hard.
Places.
The comfortable place,
yes.
But magic does happen when you do poke and ask questions, and it awakens others too. So,
well, thank you.
Thank you so much for your work.
Thanks
and
for the opportunity to share our work, because there are a lot of people in this community who need to be educated, and
right.
The more that we have awareness, the more we can bring about change.
Yeah, and as you know, as happens with these programs, every time I have a program, I have about 10 ideas of what to do with the program, and so I'm thinking, oh, we can, you know, in the springtime have some sort of forum, public forum, so people can come, because it's a very dark and scary place when you're there by yourself. I actually had my aunt committed suicide. I was 4 years old when she was going through a divorce, and she had two young children. It was her second marriage, and she was, I think, somebody I would have loved. Again, I was 4 years old, so I never got to know her. But from everything that I've seen, she was an incredibly beautiful, beautiful woman. But I think she was also a very strong woman, which in those days, it's not a great place. It was not a bit of a dangerous place to be. And I think she came from a very emotional, abusive relationship as well. But she took her own life. And I remember that, and it always stuck with me. It's like, why? And actually, when I was going through my own experience, I came to that point, and I really believe her story saved me from going to that place, because you do lose yourself. It's very frightening.
Powerful, yeah.
It is.
Sorry for your loss of her.
Yeah, but today I think she's here, and
right.
She's in a different way, and
yes.
Moving me along in different ways as well. So,
Well, if I could just let your listeners know that they can learn more about our organization by going to our website, which is www.centerforjudicialexcellence.org. And we have an e-newsletter we send out with regular events around Marin. We're completely supported 100% by individual donors and concerned community members, and we like to have house parties where we come and share about our work. And so if you're interested in staying connected or learning more about what we're up to, I'd welcome people to reach out. And we would love to come and do a forum on campus in the spring. And there's a film coming out, which is premiering at the Awareness Film Festival in Los Angeles on October 7th, that I was interviewed for about the very family court crisis we've been discussing. And it was a filmmaker from the UK who came here and exposed what's happening in US courts. It's a problem over there as well, but it's a really powerful film and might be great for the campus community to see that. Maybe we could do a screening and keep the conversation going.
We have to keep the conversation and support the others going through this. So thank you so much, Kathleen Russell, Director of Center for Judicial Excellence, and Sarah Curlew. Of a very protective mother. Thank you for being the voice and the strength and the model for so many people. MA candidate in human rights education at University of San Francisco. You will be a force. I can see that.
Thank you.
And this is Take Back Radio, 102.3 FM, or radio.dominican.edu worldwide. Next week, right, we're getting ready for the Jimmy Carter Jamboree, an opportunity to honor a president and learn about all his human rights issues and humanitarian efforts, as well as environmental policies, and so much that this living president, our 39th president, has stood for as we celebrate his 93rd birthday, starting October 1 through October 8th. Next week, Randall Sequeira of the Dream Farmers is joining me. We're going to talk about Jimmy Carter, farming, giving, and living the music dream that he has going, and deep values, and a lot of the values that his music sings to. And also Alejandro Palacios of CMCM is going to join us to talk about the upcoming Free Latin Film Festival in San Rafael that following weekend. And again, you're listening to Radio Take Back Radio, 102.3 FM and radio.dominican.edu. This is Barbara McVeigh, and we'll catch you next week.
But it's this good, you know? Love, it's just, I mean, we're young. We don't need to be all tied down.
You make the night feel good.
Yeah, honestly.
Baby, I'll fight you.